Now that we've heard about some current opportunities that ebooks offer publishers, we're going to explore what's coming in the near future. We asked Mike Schatzkin to help us out with that. He's the founder and CEO of a publishing industry consulting company called Idealogical. We begin by talking about one of the big looming stories in the business, the planned merger of publishers Penguin and Random House, which Schatzkin says is huge.
One publisher up till now could not essentially create a bookstore in a drugstore. They wouldn't have enough titles that mattered in order to be able to do that. But Random House and Penguin, between them, might. Another way they might create additional distribution is through a subscription, an ebook subscription service. Before Random and Penguin merged, no single publisher would have had enough of the most commercial titles to make something like that work. They might.
So is there any chance I might come across a store in the future that sells only books from Penguin Random House?
You will come across stores that will sell books from only Penguin Random House, but they won't be bookstores. They will be stores that have a little book department that is perfectly adequately serviced for most people's purposes by Penguin and Random House.
Now, there's another bit of jargon that gets thrown around when people talk about the digital transition in publishing, and that's platforms. And you've suggested that new platforms could be a big topic in the coming year. What exactly do you mean by that in plain speak? What kind of platforms are we talking about?
What has really caught my attention in platforms is what's going on in children's books. If you want to capture the audience for children's books, then you have to make an environment for reading them that teachers and parents endorse. So, for example, Scholastic, which has fabulous reach into schools through teachers, is creating an ebook reading platform called Storia. And Storia is a complete environment that is, you can find books and ultimately purchase them through Storia. And they provide tools to help parents and teachers oversee their kids' reading. So if a parent or teacher get a kid reading on Storia, you're not going to be able to get a book to that kid except through Storia. And Storia is not the only platform of its kind. Reading Rainbow, which is a longstanding television show, has a platform called RR Kids. Both Barnes & Noble and Amazon are trying to make their Nook and Kindle platforms parent-friendly, giving parents control so that parents will encourage the kids to do all the reading through the platform. And what that means is that power transfers to the platform owner from the individual title or author.
Is there any indication that readers might not like that? I mean, one of the joys of having a book is it doesn't matter what bookstore you get it from. It still works. The book still works.
Well, I think you're certainly right that, I mean, obviously there'll be readers that won't join the platforms. And I'm not trying to suggest in any way that they would suddenly have a majority of the readers.
But as a reader, would you suddenly then say, I guess I'm never going to get to read a book from this author or that author just because I don't want to join such and such a platform?
Well, I think we've already had that experience. You know, 20 years ago, much more than today, there were people that chose their books from what Book of the Month Club offered them. And Book of the Month Club did not offer them books that were Literary Guild main selections because they didn't have rights to them. And in fact, in a more subtle way, people shop from what's inside a bookstore. What's inside a bookstore is a small percentage of the total number of books that are available. Now, it's true that some people go to Barnes & Noble once a week, and if they want something that they're not finding there, they can go online at bn.com or Amazon and look through a wider selection. But I think a lot of people shop however they shop and choose from what's available to them when they shop, and I think people will make that choice, and some of them will make it around platforms.
Mike Schatzkin is founder and CEO of a publishing industry consulting company called Idealogical. Mike Schatzkin, thank you so much for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Audie Cornish. One of the central tensions in publishing can be summed up in this online book trailer.
What do you have there?
It's for a kid's story by Lane Smith.
It's a book.
Do you scroll down?
Nope. I turn the page. It's a book.
Can you blog with it?
No. It's a book.
What is a book anymore in a world of Kindles, Nooks, and iPads, and eager talk about new platforms and distribution methods? Put simply, traditional publishers are traveling a long and confusing road into the digital future. We're going to spend some time this hour strolling down that road, exploring this time of transition, what it means for publishers, for readers, and for writers, too.
About 3 years ago, we were told by a lot of people that paper books were going away. That has not happened.
And yet, author Margaret Atwood is dabbling in the brave new world of digital publishing. We'll hear more from her soon. To begin, here's the conventional wisdom about publishing. E-books are destroying the business model. People expect them to be cheaper than physical books, and that drives down prices. But as we hear from Zoe Chase of NPR's Planet Money, the story is not so simple.
There's a big problem with digital books for publishers, the same problem that exists for the record labels. People steal digital content, and there's not the same stigma to pirating an ebook as there is to holding up a Barnes & Noble. So that's a big issue. Turns out, though, that even with that, some publishers are doing great.
Yeah, we've had an incredible year. Last year was the best year in the company's history. This year was we beat that, which I didn't think was even possible.
Dominique Rocca is CEO of Sourcebooks. She says it's because of digital publishing, not in spite of it, that they're doing so well.
It's been an amazing ride.
Turns out there are a bunch of huge advantages for publishers. A big one, the price isn't fixed the way it is with physical books.
The challenging thing about physical books is that we price once.
So 10 years ago, a publisher sends out their books to the bookstore with the price stamped on the cover. After that, they were done. They couldn't put it on sale to sell more books.
The exciting thing about digital books is that we actually get to test and price differently. We can even price on a weekly basis.
Once you have this tool of a price that can be adjusted in an instant, you can do whatever you want with that tool. You can use it, say, to get publicity. That's what Little Brown did with the title An Unfinished Life, a Kennedy biography. In the middle of November, Little Brown dropped the price from $9.99 to $2.99 for 24 hours, the digital equivalent of a one-day-only sale.
That sparks sales, it gets people talking about it, and you've just expanded the market.
Terry Adams is a publisher at Little Brown. Dropping the price of An Unfinished Life got people's attention.
Here, we had an opportunity to increase the audience.
To goose sales. In this case, the book launched up onto the bestseller list. And because you can jack it back up again, you're not stuck there losing money. This kind of promotion leads to discovery, something that used to just happen in bookstores. But with fewer of those around, publishers are using price to create discovery. It's like making music available for streaming so that someone will discover an artist and then buy a record. Speaking of, if you read the new iBook 40 Years of Queen, you'd find it's got links in it to iTunes, where you could buy this. Another huge advantage of ebooks, publishers can sell you things inside your book. It's still quite rare, but that's where digital publishing is headed. Enough with the good news. There's still one downside of ebooks putting pressure on publishers, besides thieves, that you may have noticed, actually, just in the past day or so.
We actually don't have a good gifting tradition yet for ebooks.
Physical books are still the Christmas presents. Zoe Chase, NPR News. Pressure.
As we approach the end of the year, we've been asking people for their best of 2012 lists. Let's turn to some books you may have missed. You should think about giving them a listen. We're talking about audiobooks. Robin Witten reviews them. She's editor and founder of Audiophile magazine, and she brought in some favorites. Robin Witten, welcome to the program.
Thank you, David. Glad to be here.
Well, let's get right to one of the books on your list, and it's called Toothiana by William Joyce. Is that right?
Yes, it is. What a great name.
Yeah,
really.
I like it. Let's give a listen.
Petter and Fogg, feeling wild and industrious, catapulted themselves to the hollow of a tall tree, where they had erected a hideout devoted to solving ancient mysteries, such as, why was there such a thing as bedtime, and what could they do to eliminate it forever?
sounds like this might be a good book for listening on a family road trip. What's the story here?
This is fantastic. Well, Toothiana is one of William Joyce's books that's in the Guardians of Childhood series. And he has the Tooth Fairy, the Easter Bunny, and St. Nicholas, who all become superheroes through these various books.
Uh-huh.
And they are the guardians of childhood and of dreams in particular, good dreams.
What qualities really make it clear that a book is perfect for audio?
Well, oftentimes episodic stories and mysteries, in fiction, it's easier to see how audiobooks and the audio medium work.
And Robin, when you do have a sample of nonfiction on your list, it's a book called The Art of Power. It's about Thomas Jefferson. Let's give a listen to that.
At age 10, Thomas was sent into the woods alone with a gun. The assignment, the expectation, was that he was to come home with evidence that he could survive on his own in the wild. The test did not begin well. He killed nothing, had nothing to show for himself. The woods were forbidding. Everything around the boy, the trees and the thickets and the rocks and the river, was frightening and frustrating. He refused to give up or give in. He soldiered on until his luck finally changed. Finding a wild turkey caught in a pen, the family story went, he tied it with his garter to a tree, shot it, and carried it home in triumph.
it really is. It's nonfiction, but it's almost told in a kind of fiction-style way. You kind of get into the scene and feel, like you're imagining yourself there.
Right, and I think that the author, wanted us to do that. And so, some readers do that naturally. And you can be that involved as you see the words on the page. But in audio, the narrator helps place you there in the woods.
One question I have, some of these audiobooks, they bring in celebrities to do the reading. Like Colin Firth is reading The End of the Affair, a book by Graham Greene. How do you think that? I mean, yes. It's a good idea to have a famous voice?
Well, I think that what is quite exciting about that is for a lot of people who've never really considered or been interested in an audiobook, they think, oh, I love Colin Firth. I love his voice.
From the screen, yeah.
From the screen. And so they may try something, and they also may not really know who Graham Greene is or ever, encountered this book, but they're attracted to it. So they're going to give it a try. And, Colin Firth's voice is beautiful, and he has a really special way of, being inside this story, which is actually a personal favorite of his.
I said, Henry, you're almost a stranger. And saw his eyes light up, as though we were old friends. Bendrix, he said, with affection. And yet the world would have said he had the reasons for hate, not me.
And he brings across some of the interesting intimacy that the audiobook medium is really known for, because the book is so intimate and it's in your head as if he's telling just you.
Well, Robin Witten, thank you so much for joining us to talk about this.
Thank you, David. It was great.
Robin Witten of Audiophile Magazine with some recommendations for books to listen to.
And on this final day of 2012, let's listen to the names of some of the people who bring you Morning Edition every day, starting with our directors Lindsay Toddy and Esma Khalid. Our program is edited by Chuck Holmes, Renita Jablonski, and David McGuffin, and produced by Nicole Beemster-Bohr and Nishant Dahiya.
Our engineering supervisor is Kevin Langley, and the technical director is Kurt Stoniker.
Our senior supervising editors are Kitty Isley and Shannon Rhodes. The editorial staff includes Rena Advani, Shanita Anderson, Ann Hawk, Anita Huslin, Jordana Hochman, Maeve McGoran, Arnie Seipel, Jessica Smith, Martha Wexler, and Kenya Young, with Nina Gregory and Arzu Rezvani at NPR West.
Our senior producers are Cindy Carpian, Barry Gordimer, and Jim Wildman. Senior supervising producers are Cara Tallo and Tracy Wall. The production staff includes Oliver Dearden, Caitlin Dickerson, Nick Fountain, Lindsay Garrison, Jess Gittner, Travis Larchuk, Kevin Leahy, Lauren McGaughey, Steve Monroe, Vince Pearson, Leah Scarpelli, Selena Simmons-Duffin, and Rachel Ward, with Sasha Woodruff out at NPR West.
Well said. Let's add some more. Audio engineers include Stacey Abbott, Brian Jarbo, Zachary Coleman, Chris Whitfield, Dennis Nielsen, Greg Gavin, Nathan Bark, Renee Pringle, Tom Marquito, Gerald Tennant, Michael Cullen, Arthur Halliday, Laurent, Ted Mebane, Neil T. Vault, Cal Southworth, Melissa Marquis, William Plummer, Burke Hahn, and Sean Phillips, with Marcia Caldwell, Theo Mondel, Patrick Murray, and Leo DeLagula at NPR West.
The executive editor of news programming is Ellen McDonnell. Morning Edition's theme music was written by BJ Lederman, and it was arranged by Jim Pugh.
And let me say a final time that Morning Edition's executive producer is Madalika Kasicka. She's moving to an even bigger job as NPR's executive editor, also putting out a book. So she steps away from the management of this program.
Madalika arrived at NPR in 2006, and whether they know it or not, listeners to this program have shared in her passions and obsessions, from crime novels to urban growth,
to race in America, to international news,
to 24, Homeland, and celebrity chef Nigella Lawson.
Now, if that sounds like an eclectic list, that is the point. It is a big and varied world, and she worked to reflect it all.
And whatever didn't fit into one day's program, she would push to include it the next day.
And tomorrow's program goes on with the same spirit. We say goodbye with this music, honoring the woman who's the not-so-hidden hand behind NPR's extensive team coverage of all things James Bond. The name is Sicca, Madalika Kasicka. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm David Green.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Audie Cornish. And sometimes we miss great books, a little gem of a debut novel or a memoir by an unknown writer. They are the ones that got away, as we're calling our series about arts and entertainment we missed this year. But, and this is a big but, sometimes the one that got away is the elephant in the room. Everyone knows about it. It's one of the biggest sellers of all time. It's a cultural phenomenon. Yep, I'm talking about 50 Shades of Grey. NPR's Lynn Neary admits that she did her best to ignore it until she couldn't anymore.
It wasn't just that you couldn't go anywhere without hearing about it, nor was it the record-breaking sales. It was the news that every employee, let me say that again, every single employee of Random House USA was getting a bonus of $5,000. I had to take notice. They call it the 50 Shades bonus. And $5,000 is not chump change. Elena Ligueros, who works in the digital marketing department at Random House, was at the Christmas party where the news was announced.
And everyone went crazy. I mean, people started cheering, and I hugged the person next to me. Everyone went nuts, and the cheers went on for several minutes.
Now, Random House has had some other huge bestsellers in recent years. After all, it also published the Girl with the Dragon Tattoo trilogy. Paul Bogarts, who did the PR for both series, says in publishing, these kinds of books are known as miracle publications because they take on a life of their own. But, Bogarts says, nothing has ever gone as viral as the 50 Shades books.
No series of books has sold more copies in a shorter window of time. It took us 4 years to sell 20 million copies of Stieg Larsson's Girl Books. It took us 9 months to sell 35 million copies of E.L. James' 50 Shades trilogy.
But surely, I asked Bogarts, there were others like myself who resisted the allure of a romance novel heavily laced with S&M.
The resistors were few and far between. And, you know, as a PR professional, it was a unique experience, to say the least. I mean, every PR guy dreams of the day when a reporter calls asking you to explain the sudden popularity of Benoit Balls. These are things that are hard to explain if you haven't actually read the books. If you have, not so difficult.
And no, I am not going to explain how Benoit Balls fit into the plot. And yes, I do know how. You see, I'm a bit of a prude, which is why I didn't want to read the books in the first place. But when I think about it, it might have been snobbery, not prudery, that made me resist for such a long time.
Most people that I heard that were wary of it, really, it was the first. It was snobbery.
That's the writer M.J. Rose. She says a lot of book people were less than impressed with the lineage of 50 Shades. It wasn't just self-published. It began as a fan fiction version of the Twilight series. The clumsy virgin Bella morphed into the clumsy virgin Anna. And the vampire Edward became Christian, the fabulously wealthy, unbelievably gorgeous guy who introduces Anna to the joys of kinky sex.
I was in a bookstore in New York, in the Village, and there were like 50 copies of it in the very beginning, and I asked the owner if she'd read it, and she said, no, I'd never read it. And there were 50 copies of it, and she couldn't keep it in stock.
So if a snobby New York bookstore owner and a snobby, possibly prudish public radio reporter aren't reading these books, who is? Random House employee Elena Lagueros has an idea.
I actually sent a copy to my grandmother in Iowa because I thought that she and her friends would get a kick out of it.
Wait, your grandmother in Iowa?
Yes. I thought that she might enjoy it.
Why your grandmother?
I know what she enjoys reading, and I know what a lot of the people in the assisted living home where she lives in Iowa enjoy reading. And I just thought it would be fodder for conversation.
Elena,
might give me something to talk about.
You're telling me that your grandmother and the people in her assisted living facility like reading about S&M?
They like reading romantic stories. This might be a new thing for them.
So there you have it. The secret to the success of 50 Shades is not sex, it's romance. Isn't that what women have always wanted? But if that's all it is, why were so many women buying all those gray ties? You'll just have to read the book to find out. Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.
NPR's business news today is all about the art of selling. It's true, many people consider selling to be a true art form. Of course, in some great American movies, the image of the salesman was not exactly sympathetic.
You got leads. Mitch and Murray paid good money. Get their names to sell them. You can't close the leads you're given. You can't close. You are. Hit the bricks, pal, and beat it, because you are going out.
So that's a scene from the film Glengarry Glen Ross. And to talk about the art of selling, I'm joined by author Daniel Pink, whose new book is To Sell Is Human. And Daniel, that is a brutal Alec Baldwin we're hearing there.
It's a brutal and very effective Alec Baldwin showing a particular approach to selling, a relentless predator-style approach to selling. And I think that that approach has become outdated, that sales has changed more in the last 10 years than it did really in the previous 100.
Why outdated? Why wouldn't that work today?
Well, most of what we know about sales was built for a world of information asymmetry. The seller always had more information than the buyer. 20 years ago, when Mamet wrote that play that made into a movie, when you walked into a Chevy dealer, the Chevy dealer knew a heck of a lot more about cars than you ever could.
And we were always, as the buyer, curious about, am I being sold a lemon? Is there something wrong with this car?
Precisely, because you didn't have the adequate information. And so this is why we have the principle of caveat emptor. Buyer beware. You gotta beware when the other guy knows a lot more than you. Well, something curious has happened in the last 10 years, in that you can walk into a car dealership with the invoice price of the car, something that even the salesmen, women in car dealers, didn't know too long ago. And so in a world of information parity, or at least something close to it, we've moved – caveat emptor is still good advice, but equally good advice for the sellers is caveat venditor, seller bewares.
Okay, so people selling things are more vulnerable, but – a lot of people are selling things.
Well, that's actually another big point. We have this, there's an idea out there that salespeople have been obliterated by the internet, which is just not supported by the facts. In 2000, there were about 1 in 9 American workers worked in sales. That is, their job was to convince someone else to buy something. So then, what's happened over the last 12 years? Explosion of new technologies. Today, 1 in 9 American workers works in sales. But I think what's interesting is that if you look at those other 8 in 9, they're in sales too. That is, a huge portion of what white-collar workers do on the job is what I call non-sales selling. Persuading, influencing, convincing other people to part with resource, pitching ideas in meetings, asking the boss for a raise, trying to raise money from investors. And so at some level, we're all in sales now.
Well, let me ask you, if I'm hearing you correctly, you're saying that everyone, all of us, are doing a lot more selling than we realize. And if that's a thing, as you said, then one key is for us to just all realize it and get better at it. One way to get better that you found was you took part in these exercises where listening was very key. Tell me a bit about that.
Oh, sure. Well, one of the interesting findings that comes out in the social science, basically the myth of the extroverted salesperson.
Mm-hmm.
We have this idea that extroverts are better salespeople. As a result, extroverts are more likely to enter sales. Extroverts are more likely to get promoted in sales jobs. But if you look at the correlation between extroversion and actually sales performance, that is, how many times the cash register rings, the correlation is almost zero.
Huh.
It's really quite remarkable.
Introverts can sell as well as extroverts.
Ah, not quite.
Okay.
Let's think about a spectrum and say on a scale from 1 to 7, where 1 is extremely introverted, 7 is extremely extroverted. The 6s and 7s, the people who get hired, the gregarious, backslapping types of the stereotype, they're not very good. Okay? Now, why?
Why?
They don't listen very well. They're talking all the
time. They're spending too much time talking about themselves or whatever they want to be talking about.
They're spending too much time talking. They're not quiet. They don't know when to shut up. They don't listen very well. They're not attuned to the other person. They sometimes can overwhelm people. Now, to your question, does that mean introverts are better? No. The ones and twos, they're not very good either. They often are not assertive enough. They're skittish about striking up conversations. What this new research, and it's very exciting, it's accepted for publication but actually not published yet, is the people who do the best are what social psychologists call ambiverts.
These ambiverts.
Are ambiverts.
These are people in the middle.
You got it. Not totally extroverted, not totally introverted. The threes, fours, and fives. They know when to shut up. They know when to speak up. They know when to push. They know when to hold back. And so the best people at convincing, persuading others, whether in a traditional sales environment or these other kinds of environments, are these ambiverts.
Well, there was an exercise that you described with an improvisational theater coach. Tell me about that.
One of the abilities that matters most is this ability of improvisation. That is, if you're perfectly attuned, super clear pitch goes awry, as it will, how do you respond? And the principles of improvisational theater help us out on that. So we did all kinds of groovy exercises where we mirror each other's patterns, which is a little bit freaky, and also some listening exercises where I had to sit face-to-face with this actually pretty senior executive at a television network, and he had to tell me something that was bothering him. And I had to look him in the eye when he told me that, but I couldn't respond to him for 15 seconds.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Can we try that in here? I mean, you and I are face-to-face right now.
We could try that, but I don't want to freak you out here, David.
I'll try to be strong.
Okay. Okay, so here's what it would be like. So I would tell you something that might be sort of a concern of mine,
okay,
and you would listen to it, and then you would look me in the eye and wait 15 seconds before responding to me. So let me think about something that is on my mind right now. Let's see. Oh, I got something on my mind right now. I have a new book coming out, and I think it's really good, but I'm a little nervous about how it's going to be received in the world.
Okay, that does get a little awkward.
That was only 5 seconds.
Okay, I got to work on that.
The stare was so solid. Well, the idea is that we tend to move too quickly, and what the best salespeople of any kind know is really about listening. It's really about understanding the other person's perspective, hearing what they're really saying. And one really profound way to do that is to slow down.
Daniel Pink, this has been fun. Thanks for stopping by.
My pleasure, David. Thanks for having me.
He never loses a staring contest. That's Daniel Pink, the author of To Sell Is Human, The Surprising Truth About Moving Others. And that's the business news on Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Greene.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.